KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey all you fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, April 28th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Arrow.
And this week we've got a special double stuffed episode for you. I'm talking about two fishes of the week, four guests, one Indo-Ryuk Basin. It's going to be a good time. We're talking about the Chihuahua Chub and the Guzman Beautiful Shiner, which I must say, I'm happy we finally have a Cypronella on the show after 4+ years.
Yeah, so Guy mentioned we've got a full house today with four guests. Jill Wick is the Native Fish Program Manager with the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, and she joined us way back in Season 1 for our Helix episode. We've also got Serena Couture with our New Mexico Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. Robert Prather is here from our New Mexico Ecological Services Field Office, and Tracy Diver is joining from our Southwestern Native Aquatic Resources and Recovery Center.
Thank you.
I was wondering if we could kind of just get situated on the map, like where are we going? And if I were to be standing on the banks of this river, what would it be like? Jill, I was going to pitch it to you first as our state rep, and then maybe Serena, if you've got anything to add after that.
So these fish are found in the Membrus River Basin, which is in kind of southwestern New Mexico. There's the Gila Basin, which flows into the Colorado River, and it's just to the east of the Gila Basin. It's an endorheic basin, so it doesn't flow into any other major river. It just is a closed basin. It's a fairly decent-sized river, sandy bottom for the most part. Serena, you've been out there probably more recently than I have.
I was out there last week. It really varies where you are in the river. The Forest Service owns most headwaters of the Membrus, and that's heavily wooded. There's a lot more cobble, fairly green. The water's a little narrower, a little shallower. There's still several pools. But then as you flow down the basin, it gets wider, flatter. There's more cottonwood trees. Game and Fish and TNC also own several properties along the Membrus, and those are protected lands. And you can really tell the difference. There's some nice woody debris pools and lots of overhead cover.
And then the fish, in terms of what they look like, maybe Tracy, do you want to take Guzman Shiner and Robert Chihuahua Chub?
I can try Guzman Beautiful Shiner. It's a member of the North American minnow family, Lucicidae. Relatively small body, maybe an inch and a half in size. We usually talk millimeters in the fish world. Probably an adult would be anywhere from 50 to 70 millimeters in total length. Small, silvery, kind of an iridescent color to the Guzman Beautiful Shiner. During their reproductive period, you can see sexual dimorphic characteristics between males and females. Males will get tuberculate, they'll look at these little bumps on their nose, and then they'll also kind of get this bar behind their operculum, and they'll color up during the spawning season.
Thanks. Do you think it's justified calling it the Beautiful Shiner, considering all the other Cypronella out there?
I'm sure that's a subjective name, but...
Okay, I had to ask that because there's so many gorgeous Cypronella that we've thought about in doing this show. And I looked at some of the pictures, and I suppose it could have been a female or a non-breeding male. But I'm like, not all fish can be beautiful, but there's some other really gorgeous Cypronella out there.
Compared to the Beautiful Shiner, the Chihuahua Chub is much larger. They've got larger scales that are much more robust in terms of their body form. Usually adults are 10 to 20 centimeters, but there are some accounts of individuals being much, much larger than that. They're kind of an olive to dark color. During the breeding season, there's a reddish-orange coloration around the mouth and paired ventral fins, usually a bit more vivid in the males. They've been described as trout-like on many occasions.
I was looking at the Chihuahua Chub, and it has a face that's different than most of the things in genus Gila that I'm used to seeing. Its mouth kind of reminds me a little bit of like a shad or even a jack or something, which just caught me as odd. And if you have any information about why it looks like that, I'm curious.
So I will say, you know, down here at Dexter, we have bony tail, we have humpback, we have cranigans. So we have a lot of the healing. The first time I saw Chihuahua Chub, I said the same thing. I was like, that is a funky looking Gila.
Thank you.
Chubby's sort of face comparatively doesn't have that long pointed nose. Like you'd almost think with a robuster or something. But yes, I thought the same thing. I was like, that is a very different looking Gila. And I don't know if that's part of the evolutionary history of it sort of being almost outside of the Colorado River Basin. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
The isolation alone can sometimes lead to really any characteristics and species. This fish has been isolated for a long time. It is one of the few, if not the only, Gila that's found outside of the Colorado River Basin. And so evolutionarily speaking, there's some reasons why they might be a lot more unique than other members.
Before doing research for this show, I hadn't even heard of the Guzman Basin. And I guess I'm just curious why you guys think it's so special and so important to be focusing all these efforts within this area.
The Members Basin is a closed system, which is fairly unique. It's about 91 miles. It starts at the headwaters in the Forest Service, like I mentioned before, and flows down a long time ago into Mexico, into the Guzman Basin. And it has not connected in many, many years. Historically, there are only a couple native fish in the Members Basin, and they can't go anywhere else. Right now, the Chihuahua Chub exists in the Members River, and they're federally listed as threatened, as well as the Rio Grande Sucker, which is a great native species, and then also the Longfin Dace, which is a naturalized species that popped over from the Gila River Basin right next door. And so there's not a huge species diversity. The Guzman Beautiful Shiner was extirpated in about the 1960s. We're not sure of the exact date, but they have not been seen since. And we have a unique opportunity to help this system recover and populate it with the species that originated there and evolved there.
Okay. So you mentioned that it's been extirpated. I'm curious about the history with this fish. If it's been extirpated, was there a population being held in captivity at the time? It sounds like it was a while ago that it was lost, and that seems like that would be quite a bit of foresight to hold on to that. Or, basically, how do we have a source material for this population? How'd that come to be?
The Southwestern Native Aquatic Resources and Recovery Center in Dexter, New Mexico, our facility is formerly known as the Dexter National Fish Hatchery and Technology Center. So sometimes we just call it Dexter. Actually has the only population of Guzman Beautiful Shiner in the United States. So as Serena mentioned, the species was extirpated or is now extinct from the wild in the United States. A captive population was established in 1978 from 16 individuals. We've actually monitored the genetic diversity of that population and found that it's actually relatively comparable to that of source populations down in Mexico. So we actually have a relatively unique system down here in that we've maintained genetic diversity in spite of a relatively small founding population that probably went through a bottleneck event. And that's probably because we maintain that captive population in earthen ponds. They're allowed to naturally reproduce, so they have natural mate choice. They forage on their own. So they're maintained in as naturalized of a captive situation as possible, which is relatively unique in the propagation fish world. They've been in captivity for almost 50 years, and Serena, Robert, and others are trying to work to get them on the landscape.
50 years? How many generations is that for this fish?
That's an amazing question. I don't totally know for sure, but a lifespan is probably about 1 to 3 years. Do the math. Anywhere from could be upwards 50 generations to maybe even half that. It depends on how fast they breed, and some of that isn't totally known. So I'd say 25 is a safe bet.
What are some of the major threats that have led to this, or some of the major things on the landscape that have led these fish to be at the status that they are today?
So a lot of it has to do with habitat loss and degradation. There's a very small amount of water, and there's a lot of water users in the basin. And so the stream dries in several places. And especially for Chihuahua chub, they require some deeper pools. And, you know, that ultimately has resulted in less ideal habitat for them. In addition to less habitat, it's become severely degraded through wildfires and post-wildfire flooding. those are some of the major threats. There's other minor threats, like some of the non-native species that get into the system. Occasionally diseases. There was some parasitism problems in the 90s, but yeah, it's mostly habitat loss and degradation.
Speaking on some of that habitat loss, I was reading something, and I think this was put out by the Nature Conservancy, a little article, that despite some of these drought issues and these dry reaches in the Membris, that you guys had pit tagged some of these Chihuahua chubs, and that they were moving around better than you might think. And I'm wondering if some of you guys could speak to that.
There were some studies done recently with some pit tagged individuals, and there was one particular individual that moved from pretty far down in the Membris to up near the headwaters. And so this was a result that was kind of unexpected, especially given some of the loss of connectivity between these reaches. And the chub appears to be a bit more mobile and capable of moving throughout the Membris than we might have initially expected.
Generally, it seems like habitat's the issue. And so if habitat is the issue, is there anything that can reasonably be done to improve habitat for this fish? And if so, are there projects underway, things that have been going on? Have you seen the benefits of that yet, if these projects have been started in the past?
This is Jill. The Game and Fish Department has done a number of habitat restoration projects in the Membris River over the past decade or so. We own a property right in the town of Membris, and then the Nature Conservancy owns a property just upstream of there. And we've done some fairly big habitat restoration work there, where we've created big pour-over pools with big root wads. Chub really like deep pools and lots of cover, places for them to hide and things like that. And so we created that type of habitat in both of those locations. We did that almost a decade ago now. And there's been some changes with that habitat over time because there's been a lot of flooding in the Membris more recently. But the chub seem to love those habitats. They use them quite a bit. And we saw, you know, pretty good increase in numbers of fish using those habitats and in those areas after we did that. Game and Fish has a different property lower down in the lower part of the Membris. And we built a refuge pond there in 2021. It's not connected to the river at all, but it's a big pond that has a bunch of cover, and we've stocked Chihuahua chub in there a few times. And so it's kind of a additional population that's not connected to the river, so that when we do see these big flood events or some kind of stochastic event that affects the river itself, those fish are protected a little bit more from that. We did see some major flooding after a fire a couple of years ago, and we were able to take fish out of the river and put them in the pond with the idea that we would then put them back in the river once the effects of the fire and flooding is recovered.
Yeah. Jill, so last week we talked with some folks from Utah, some state folks from their DNR, about the least chub. And I guess from a state perspective, do you have a sense of, you know, does the public know about this fish? How do they feel about it? I'm just kind of curious. Yeah, it sounds like both of them are really, really unique to the area, and I'm just curious what people think of them.
This is a really rural part of the state. There's just not a lot of people in the southwestern part of New Mexico really at all. Probably not a lot of people know what a Chihuahua chub is or has ever heard of a Chihuahua chub. I would say probably from people that don't live in or near the Membris River, they've never heard of a Chihuahua chub.
I think Jill's probably pretty spot on. But in and around the Membris area, there are folks that live there that are aware of the species and its existence there. Serena and I were down there recently, and we talked with a local landowner, and he was very excited to see us there and definitely wanted to sort of flex his knowledge of this rare species. It was exciting to hear, you know, someone local get excited about the species. And so there is some very small level of awareness, but statewide, if you ask the average person, they would probably have no idea what you're talking about.
And I guess in a similar vein, if we're talking about the Guzman Beautiful Shiner, and, you know, these are in a captivity situation right now and potentially hopefully putting them back on the landscape, how do people feel about that? Do you have a sense of, I guess, how that might be received at some point?
I think it depends which sort of group you're talking to. I'd like to assume that most people would be pretty favorable to the idea of getting Beautiful Shiner back on the landscape. As with any sort of project like this, you might have landowners that become concerned with water right issues or ESA specific issues. But in this particular system, there's already a listed species, and so things wouldn't change much for them.
I do want to ask another question, because we brought up fire a couple times here. And so preferably talking to someone who's maybe been out in the field and seen these effects, what really is the issue with fire? Is it that the streams are getting too warm for the fish? We've mentioned the flooding associated with it. Is that just because of a loss of vegetation, or is it that there's ash being washed into the water? So really, what is the core issue or issues that the fire cause in this system? And are these unnatural, or is the system in some ways evolved to exist with fire.
These systems are evolved with fire. Historically, fire has been very good for this system. It comes through, it kind of cleans stuff up. However, in recent years, there have been a lot more wildfires, and they've been burning more frequently and at higher intensities. In 2022, there is the Black Fire, which was the largest wildfire in the Gila National Forest. That was pretty catastrophic for the Mimbre system. It burned pretty intensely in the headwaters. And when fires burn over streams, the fire itself maybe doesn't affect the stream as much. It burns over it. It's really the after effects that affect the stream. So you get debris washed into the stream, you get heavy ash flows, and it kind of chokes out the fish or anything else that lives in there. You get destabilization from the stream banks, and that's just the immediate after effects of the fire. In 2022, the fire burned around May. Starting in late June, we had record monsoon seasons. The entire system was just flooded out. This Mimbre River is probably 10 feet at its widest point. It had extended all across the floodplain. It was a torrential black sludge going down the river. That combined with the ash flow creates an inhospitable environment for these fish, and then it changes the habitat like Jill touched on earlier. Historically, these would happen more frequently and at different scales, and the fish have evolved to work with them, and they do still persist. The fire did not wipe out the chub in this last big fire, and they're reproducing.
Anybody else want to add on to that?
I think I would just add that part of the strategy for conservation of these fish around that issue is this idea of trying to create larger populations and kind of this idea of creating a metapopulation where when fish are eliminated from some part of the stream, there's other areas that can repopulate that. And that's really what we're aiming for in conservation of these fish so that they're more resilient when these events happen and there's fish out there on the landscape that survive in one area. If they don't survive in another, they can repopulate. That's kind of like our approach to conservation in the face of future wildfire and all of these things that we're looking at trying to mitigate into the future.
To follow up on that point that you just made, Jill, so the Mimbre River, it sounds like that's kind of confined to the United States, but this basin is both U.S. and Mexico. There are populations of some of these fish that continue to exist in Mexico. So I'm just curious if there is any cooperation or coordination between federal or state agencies in the U.S. and their counterparts south of the border, or if that's not really something that's going on.
We do assume that there could and might be populations that still exist in Mexico. It's been quite a while since we've had surveys done down there. But cooperating with the folks in Mexico is definitely something we'd like to do going forward. Our office's approach and all of our partners that, you know, work in the conservation of these fish, I think, are very open and like the idea of including Mexico in the recovery and conservation of these species where possible.
So you've got this basin, the Guzman Basin that Guy mentioned, and then the Yaqui Basin. Can somebody speak to that one a little bit? Because I know there's a couple of subpopulations here, at least with the beautiful shiner.
So yeah, Guzman Basin has Guzman beautiful shiner. And then on the other side of the Continental Divide is the Rio Yaqui or the Yaqui Basin. And in that basin, it's what we call Yaqui Beautiful Shiner. So on the east side of the Continental Divide, we have Cipronella formosa formosa. And then on the west side of the Continental Divide is Cipronella formosa Mern's Eye. So we have two described subspecies. And we actually have a partner refuge, San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, who also had a population of beautiful shiner that was extirpated. And then they recolonized that population in 1990 with a much larger population size collected from the Rio Yaqui itself. So it kind of actually has a very similar fauna on the west side of the Continental Divide with beautiful shiner and Chihuahua chub here. So kind of an interesting mirror-like comparison that, you know, drainage divide has kind of created speciation and division between those species and populations.
Awesome. Thank you.
Speaking of, you know, trying to get folks to appreciate this, see this fish, this one not being out in the wild, you mentioned that it is at Dexter. Is that a facility that the public can go and see, or is that sort of off limits? And then what other fish do they got up there?
So Dexter, we are open to the public. It depends on, you know, the number of visitors and everything. But if you call ahead of time, we can certainly arrange for larger groups. We are, as far as I understand, the largest endangered fish hatchery in the United States. We currently have 14 endangered fishes on station, a long list of mostly Western desert fishes.
I love the desert fishes. It's awesome. I'd be curious, just because you all work in different offices, and Jill, you're with the state. I'd love to hear just like a very brief summary of like what your office does. I'd just love to hear just anything you'd like to put out to the public.
My program, the Native Fish Program for New Mexico Game and Fish, works on federally threatened, endangered fish across the state, as well as other imperiled species. So our general focus is working on recovery of federally listed species, as well as other fish that we've identified as at risk, and trying to do conservation work to prevent listing for those species. We work on a variety of different fish across the entire state. I think we actively do conservation on around 28 or 30 species, and then a few aquatic invertebrate species as well as fish.
Robert, how about you with Ecological Services? What is that?
Yeah, so in Ecological Services, I'm involved in the recovery and conservation of these species, but a big part of what I do is involving the Endangered Species Act. So it might be like Section 7 consultation. And for those who are listening who aren't aware, that's sort of like an interagency cooperation process that we do when there's another federal agency that is going to do an action that might impact one of these species. We consult with them and issue a biological opinion, which pretty much is our analysis of whether that action may impact the species and how we would suggest, you know, minimizing those impacts and doing those actions in a way that doesn't jeopardize the existence of the species. I also am involved in the issuance of permits, and I'll review those for folks that are going to be working with these species.
Yeah, my office, the New Mexico Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office, is located in Albuquerque, and we work all over the state. We've got biologists for each major basin. We work in the Gila, the Pecos, the Rio Grande, and the San Juan. They're all threatened and endangered fishes in each one of those basins. We work on monitoring, restoration. We work a lot with our partners. We work with the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. We work a lot with the Forest Service, with private contracting entities, the Nature Conservancy, you name it. We're trying to monitor and provide information to Robert, to the state, and all work together to see if we can improve the outlook on some of these fish.
Tracy, we're not just a fish hatchery, we're also a technology center. So we have a genetic, we do everything from population genetics, phylogenetics, and we also do environmental DNA monitoring. We also have a fish health lab co-located here as well. So we monitor for wild pathogens, and we also monitor for any pathogens in our population before putting them out into the wild. So we make sure we're not spreading diseases across our wild populations or bringing anything into our captive populations that might risk some of our brood stock. So for example, if we brought something in and it wiped out our only population of beautiful shiner, we may risk losing getting that fish. There's a lot of monitoring on our hatchery side that is interconnected with both our geneticists and our fish health team.
You can see why we've got so many guests for this episode.
Tracy gave a good description, I believe, of, you know, sort of the hatchery process with the Guzman Beautiful Shiner. But with respect to doing field work in the Membris, just take me through like a day in the field if you've been out there. And what are you doing? How are you making sure that you're handling these fish right? What kind of precautions do you need to take? And if you just got any fun stories, I'd love to hear them.
A typical survey that we do in the Membris, we're about to do one next week, is our spring monitoring. And we want to see how many fish are in there and how they're doing compared to previous years. And what we'll be doing is a depletion survey. We'll set up block nets on either end of a 200-meter reach that we've predetermined. We'll block off this area so the fish can't move in or out. And then we'll do a 3-pass depletion survey. We'll use the electroshocker and shock and capture every single fish that we see and put them in a bucket. And these buckets are aerated. We monitor them. We do water checks, make sure the fish are doing okay. And we'll collect all these fish, bring them to the top of the reach, and start measuring and seeing what we have. And we'll record the data for every fish we catch. And then we'll hold the fish outside of our monitoring reach in a holding pen and do it again. The goal is to sample every single fish in this reach, and from there you can extrapolate and see how many fish are in the whole system and the population numbers, look at the size classes. There's a lot of information you can get from these surveys. And we'll do some habitat measurements as well, kind of see how the river itself is changing. These fish are hardier than you might expect being threatened. We're careful with them. Electroshocking is fine. We'll do the spring population surveys, and then in the fall, we'll go in and also monitor every year. So there's two surveys in the year.
Perfect. I think Serena did a great job of describing that almost all of the fish are pit tagged. So they have a little microchip tag in them that we put in their belly. And so when we catch fish, we can use a scanner to scan. It's basically the same thing that you know. Put in your cat or dog on microchip. They each have a unique number, and so we can keep track of those fish, which is another cool aspect of our monitoring. We can tell when we caught those fish the last time or when they were tagged and what size they were, so how much they've grown and things like that.
I would love to know what motivates each of you to go to work every day and work with these fish.
I'll go first. It's a passion for me. I love it. New Mexico is just such a unique place. There's so little water here and there's so many endemic fish. It's just a really cool place to work because you get to see things and places that no one else gets to see. And I get to go there for my job. And we've done a lot of really meaningful work for fish across the state. And it's just an incredibly rewarding job. And I love it.
I'll go next. First and foremost, I've kind of been a fish nerd my whole life. And so getting to work on the conservation of these fish species is really special. These two species in particular are really interesting. I enjoy waking up and going to work and do something that I feel is valuable and really align with our mission of protecting and conserving our fish and wildlife. I wake up every day happy to show up and do that kind of work.
You guys are making me happy. Who's next?
I can go. Like Robert and Jill said, this is such a unique system. And it's really cool going out in the field from year to year, seeing how the system changes, seeing how the fish have changed, seeing them thrive, seeing maybe something happen, and then coming back the next year and seeing how it changed, and then going back to the office and being able to take what we did in the field and translate that to a recovery plan or studies and just learning about these fish, because we also don't know much about the Guzman Shiner and the Trawler Chub and just the exciting possibilities and what we can learn.
I'm from New Mexico. New Mexico is my home. I grew up thinking I was going to be a doctor wanting to help people. And then I got to do salvage for the Rio Grande Silvery Minnow and realized that a lot of these native fish need more help than I think people do. And so I quickly changed my path to native fish conservation and fish conservation in my home state. I am very fortunate that I can work with really great people. And I am really driven by using science, as Serena said, to improve the conservation of these animals because, you know, they are vanishing. And once they're gone, they're gone.
So we've got these two fish that have some similarities and some differences. Obviously, they share the same region where they live. So before we get to the end here, I think it's just important to maybe clarify some of the things that we've been talking about and do a little bit of compare and contrast with these fish. Compare and contrast the histories of these fish, where they stand now, and what folks are doing with them.
You can give this a shot. So the Chihuahua Chub and the Beautiful Shiner are visually and physically very different. The Beautiful Shiner is a small-bodied fish, and they live in streams, and they like slower moving water. They have been thriving in ponds as well. The Trawler Chub is larger. They have been confused with trout at some points throughout their history in the Membris. They do like deep pools and undercut banks. And after that, they are fairly similar in what's going on with them. They both live in these closed systems. One doesn't exist in the wild. The other is recovering at the moment from a catastrophic wildfire 3 years ago. And in Mexico, we are unsure of their status. We presume that they both are still in the streams in the Guzman Basin in Mexico, but we're not really sure. So we are working to get them going in the Membris again. We would love to reintroduce the Beautiful Shiner back into the Membris and get a healthy, self-sustaining population going. And we're working to increase the resiliency of the Chihuahua Chub that already exist in the Membris and what we can do to improve their habitat and increase off-channel refugia and really anything to help them.
Thank you. I'll add something. So if you were to just be given a brief overview of both of these fishes and sort of series of events that's happened up till today, you may be sort of mistakenly led to believe that the outcome or the outlook for both of these species is quite grim. But I'd like to argue that it's the other way around. For Chihuahua Chub, they just back in 22 experienced the largest wildfire in this area, followed by record level floods. And it didn't wipe them out. They're still out there. They're still reproducing and they're recovering. And for Guzman Beautiful Shiner, yes, they've been held at this hatchery for a long, long time. From everything we can tell, they've still got a above average level of genetic diversity in those populations at the hatchery. And we see no reason why they wouldn't thrive if given the right conditions on the landscape. And so I think if we really put our heads together here and continue doing the great work that we're doing, both of these species have a great outlook. I think that both of these species deserve some attention. They're really unique, and I hope everyone can be as excited about the recovery as all of us are.
What needs to be done before we can start putting the Guzman Beautiful Shiner back in the Membrus? What's keeping us from doing that? When do you project that we can and possibly see this fish reestablished in its native range?
So some of the things that we're working on doing is a conservation benefits agreement with not only the Department of Game and Fish and the Nature Conservancy, but perhaps maybe some of the private landowners as well. And this is a sort of agreement that assists in our recovery, but also issues them some assurances associated with the Endangered Species Act and some of the sort of nuances of how that's enforced. We've informally sort of talked about maybe fall of 26. I think that there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of things that we don't really know the answer to yet, but we're moving on those, and hopefully fall of 26, we can see them back on the landscape.
The other thing that we need to do before these fish get in is establish a repatriation plan. How are we going to put these fish in the river? How are we going to monitor them? How many fish do we need to put in? Like, what is our plan? What is our end goal here? We're not just going to throw the fish in the river. We need to monitor them, track them, and
be able to see how they're doing.
One of the bigger challenges for beautiful shiner is that they were extirpated from the Membrus so long ago that we don't really know why they were extirpated. We want to try to put them back in there, but it makes it difficult when we don't know what the cause of their extirpation is, because we don't know how to address that. So I think, you know, what Serena said about having a plan for what we're going to do and then a plan for being able to track them and monitor and try to figure that out, because there had to have been a reason that they're not there anymore, but we don't really know what that is. And so that just kind of adds another layer of challenge to doing something like this.
Why should people in New Mexico or folks visiting care about these two fish?
That's always the hardest question that people ask. I mean, it's a value. You know, I put a lot of value on biodiversity. I put a lot of value on the uniqueness of the system, the uniqueness of these fish and their ability to adapt in a desert environment. I mean, that's just incredible to me personally. You know, that's why I care about it.
I think it's cool how each state has their own kind of unique fish. Like, we just talked about some fish in Utah. Like, each state, you have some really neat stuff. So I would agree that just that natural diversity across America of fish is really cool.
Like we mentioned a couple times, we presume that there's still populations of these species in Mexico, but there might not be. It's been a while since we've surveyed. And so here in the Membrus might be the only location where these fish exist anymore and might be our only shot at recovering the species. And so it's really important. It's really unique biodiversity. And for those reasons, I think we should be excited about it.
Okay, well, thank you all so much. This was super interesting.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for having us on, Katrina and Guy. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region. We hope you continue to develop your interest and love for America's fish and the beautiful places they live.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing spring, spring. When the little blue bell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle of his work starts a tune to the moon up above. It is nature, that's all, simply telling us to fall in love. Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain the best upper sets doing. Lithuanians and let's do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it. Not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins. Some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston even beans do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, gainst their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shad do it? Waiter, bring me shad roe. In shallow shoals, English souls do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
And good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska, paradise itself. Another beautiful day. And what am I going to do today? I'm not really sure. Yes, I am. We'll start out with some, what am I starting out with? Oh, yeah, Sing Me Back Home. That's George Jones and Merle Haggard. After that, A Picture of Me Without You, and that's George. And then we have Hello, Darling, and that's Conway Twitty. So here's Sing Me. Oops. I gotta plug in my computer. I missed something here. Okay. I'm just about ready now. Got all my stuff together. Here we go.
The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his doom. I stood up to say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell, let my guitar playing friend do my request. Let him sing me back home with a song I used to hear, and make my old memories come alive, and take me away and turn back the years, and sing me back home before I die. I recall last Sunday morning, a choir from off the street came in to sing a few old gospel songs. Singers, there's a song my mama sang. Can I hear it once before you move along? Let them sing me back home with a song I used to hear, and make my old memories come alive. Take me away and turn
sang me back home before I die.
True. And if you should ever find
Yeah, the next three pieces here feature Merle Haggard and George Jones. We have You Take Me For Granted, I Don't Get Around Much Anymore, and Things Have Gone to Pieces. So, here we go.
My legs and my feet have walked till they can hardly move from trying to please you. And my back is sore from bending over backwards to just lay the world at your door. I'm trying hard to keep a smile on a sad face while deep down it's breaking my heart. And as sure as the sun shines, I'll be a lifetime not knowing if I've done my part. 'Cause you take me for granted, and it's breaking my heart. And as sure as the sun shines, a lifetime not knowing if I've done my part. The sun shines, I'll be a lifetime not knowing if I've done my part. Saturday dance, bet they crowded the floor, couldn't bear it without you, don't get around much anymore. Been invited on dates, might have gone but what for. Awfully different without you, don't get around much anymore. Well, it's all gone, I guess, but my mind's more at ease. And nevertheless, we'll stir up some old memories. Been invited on dates.
Well, well.
I might have gone, but what for?
I've heard that before myself.
It's so lonesome without you.
I miss you, George.
Don't get around much anymore.
You know, George, it's really true. You don't get around much anymore. You hadn't been to see me on a Learjet.
I'm out here right now, bro.
I know, but I was thinking about the old days when you used to take the lawnmower.
Oh, I tried to get to Amarillo, but man, it was too far with a 10 horsepower.
Well, you had a red Buick, though, didn't you?
Well, for 2 weeks I had a red Buick and found out later it was gold.
Well, as long as you don't start doing that duck?
Well, he's not so bad anymore. Nancy run him off.
It's all gone, I guess. But my mind's all at ease. And nevertheless, we'll stir up some old memories.
Been invited on dates. I might have gone, but what for? It's so lonesome without you. Don't get around much anymore.
Hey, you know, we need to get back on the radio, George. What we need to do. Hey. Don't get around much anymore. Oh, the faucet started dripping in the kitchen. And last night, your picture fell down from the wall. And today, the boss said, sorry, I can't use you anymore. And tonight the light bulb went out in the hall. Things have gone to pieces since you left me, and nothing turns out half right now it seems. There ain't nothing in my pocket but three nickels and a dime, but I'm holding to the pieces of my dreams. Somebody threw a baseball through my window, and the arm fell off my favorite chair again. The man called me today and said he'd haul my things away if I didn't get my payments made by 10. Things have gone to pieces since you left me. Nothing turns out half right now it seems. There ain't nothing in my pocket but three nickels and a dime, but I'm holding to the pieces of my dreams.
And next up we have Sick, Sober, and Sorry, George and Merle again, and, oh yeah.
Well, we're sick, sober, and sorry. Broke, disgusted, and sad. Sick, sober, and sorry. But look at the fun that we had. Well, we met with some gals in a tavern. And oh, what a beautiful dream.
Yes, they were.
Well, we had three or four, then we had several more, and that's when we went off our beam. Sick, sober, and sorry. Broke, disgusted, and sad. Sick,
sober and sorry, but look at the fun that we had. The jukebox so loudly was playing, each couple was having a ball, but all of them gals, their sweethearts and pals, I'll bet me and Merle's the sickest of all.
That's the truth.
Sick, sober and sorry, broke, disgusted and sad. Sick, sober and sorry, but look at the fun that we had. Outside we were hailing a taxi. We got one this time without fail. It sported a star. We didn't go far. Was only three blocks to the jail. Sick, sober and sorry, broke, disgusted and sad. Sick, sober and sorry, but look at the fun that we had.
And